This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for January 2008. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine. Each month on the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature highlights and readings from the upcoming issue of the magazine. I'm joined once again by Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. Hi, Don.
Hi, Chris. Today we're going to hear poems by Stephen Edgar and Lisa Furmansky, and fiction by Stuart Dybeck.
The first time that Poetry Magazine has ever published prose fiction.
Well, if it's the first piece of fiction ever, I don't want my mailing address or my license number or anything known so that I'm not the victim of repercussions.
But don't worry, because there's a lot of poetry in this piece of fiction. There's a poet in it as one of the characters, and it's got a lot of the qualities we look for in poems. We also have a few other things that we liked. One of the things I was really struck by was a little poem by Wendy Vitalock called There's Nothing More. There's nothing more erotic than one red Chilean plum slumbered in the brown palm of the curved hand of the right man.
Little Williams takeoff there, right?
Yeah, it's sort of an erotic collision of those two Williams poems, the famous ones where you get the wheelbarrow in one and the plums in the other. And this is a delicious little poem. Comes from the other point of view.
She has a sharp, witty sensibility. We've run several of her poems in the past. She lives out in Colorado. And
on the slopes of the Western Rockies, she
says. Yeah, exactly, yeah. You know, another very short poem is sort of a minimalist day today is by Kay Ryan. And we've run a lot of Kay Ryan's poems in the past. She's one of the most distinctive poets writing in America today. This little poem is called Repetition. Trying to walk the same way to the same store takes high wire balance. Each step, not exactly as before, risks chasms of flatness. One stumble alone and nothing happens. Few are the willing and fewer the champions. What I love about this poem is that disjunction that she draws between a sort of banal activity, walking to the store, and then a momentous accomplishment. You know, she actually uses the word champions. It sort of draws attention to the kind of attention that we need to pay to our daily lives, which, I mean, that poems are so good at making us do that.
Yeah, and when you see this on the page, it's a skinny little column, and each line is very short. One careens into the next, and just when you think it's slight and it's not going to hold itself up, it really grabs you, and you follow the whole thing through to the end.
Yeah, she's wonderful about interlocking these sounds in surprising ways.
Yeah, her ear follows her thinking.
Yeah.
Very closely.
Another short poem from the issue is by a new contributor, Lisa Furmansky. And Lisa Furmansky is a physician, actually, but also a poet. And we always are on the lookout for new contributors to the magazine, and we're delighted when this poem came in. It's called The History of Mothers and Sons, and here is Lisa Furmansky reading it.
All sons sleep next to mothers, then alone, then with others. Eventually, all our sons bear molars, incisors. Meanwhile, mothers are wingless things in a room of stairs, a gymnasium of bars and ropes, small arms hauling self over self. Mothers hum nonsense, driving here and there, here, there, in hollow steeds, mothers reflecting how faint reflections shiver over the road, all the deafening musts along the way. Mothers favor the moon, hook-hung and mirroring the sun, there in a berry bramble, calm as a stone. This is enough to wrench our hand out of his and simply devour him, though he exceeds even the tallest grass. Every mother recalls a lullaby and the elegy blowing through it.
You know, Auden once said that poetry is the clear expression of mixed feelings, and you get that in that last line very succinctly.
Yeah, the mixed feelings are really striking here, and I think they're kind of mirrored in the poem by the mixed sounds. So you have molars and incisors and stairs, and this poem has lines that, like the small arms of the little boy, it sort of hauls itself over itself from one clause in the sentence to the next.
Yeah, and surprising usage of language, all
the deafening musts along the way. Mothers favor the moon, hook-hung and mirroring the sun.
Yeah, and then that ravishing last line.
Every mother recalls a lullaby and the elegy blowing through it.
Yeah. Such confidence in that line. I know it to be true, but I believe it because the poem says it.
Our next poem is by another first-time contributor, Stephen Edgar. Edgar is from Australia, well-known in Australia, but not well-known in this country yet. These poems, we hope, will begin to make him better known. This poem is called Divine Rights, and it's formal. All of Edgar's work is in recognizable forms. It's striking in the way that it juxtaposes images of real horror. I think many of our listeners will recognize some of the images from their daily papers and newscasts, with images of domesticity. This is Stephen Edgar reading Divine Rights.
Sprawling like some small group of picnickers, they're propped among the shadows of the trees, though one seems drunk, spread-eagled. Nothing stirs except the flies that clog their cavities. A red cleft rules the parting of that head. You stretch a little and slide out of bed. Acres of debris are in sodden flood about the ruined village, which concedes in blackened matchwood to the tide of mud its smoking households. Rising from the weeds, arms reach up stiffly as for an embrace. Out of the mirror, you observe your face, while sunlight offers all that you desire. The Aztecs, to appease your counterparts, would hook still-living bodies from the fire, hack out and hold aloft the pulsing hearts, drenching the steps with blood, so they might give those idle brutes each day a day to live. You have today. Stark-eyed and hollow-faced, her rigid ribcage almost bursting through the skin, a girl sits in a land laid waste and stares out blankly. So then, it is you. The thought had not occurred to you before. It's you, Huitzilopochtli, God of War.
Sometimes when you hear a rhymed poem or see one in this day and age, you think there'll be something comforting about it, that it will sort of lull you. And talk about juxtaposition. These rhymes are kind of extraordinary because just taken on their own, they seem sort of ordinary, head and bed. But in the poem itself, when that couplet there at the end of the first stanza says,
A red cleft rules the parting of that head. You stretch a little and slide out of bed.
Part of the shock is in the way the decorum of this poem is violated by the images.
Yeah, it sort of struggles against that form. It's got restraint in it because it's the hand of the poet at work.
Yeah.
But it really brings something that flies off the page here, something you can't get around.
Yeah. And we ask, you know, Auden, to bring up Auden again. Auden said, poetry makes nothing happen, a very famous phrase. And, you know, the way you respond to this poem is interesting because it's easy to sort of feel good about feeling bad, to have a kind of soft, liberal reaction to a poem like this. But what the poem is actually saying, it's indicting the listener and saying your comfortable life is made possible by these depredations elsewhere. And you've got to change your life, like Rilke said.
That's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
We were trading dreams in a Jeep Cherokee that smelled of hay. Ours were the only cars left in a parking lot, vanishing in a snowfall.
That is from Stuart Dybeck in a story called Pink Ocean. It's the first story Poetry Magazine has ever published, and a strange thing to find in our pages, right, Tom?
It is a little strange. We even had to add a slight little note at the bottom so people would understand.
Be sure that it was fiction and not a memoir or a prose poem or something else, but you could easily mistake it for a prose poem the way it uses images.
I think is one of the nice things about it, and I hope the author doesn't mind our characterizing it as a bit of a hybrid. I know that he thinks of it as a work of fiction, and it is.
We actually had a chance to ask Stuart Dybeck what he was thinking when he wrote a piece of prose for a poetry magazine, and this is his response.
It really, in an odd way, gave me a carte blanche, because I knew that the readership would be a readership that was used to following associations, that was used to elliptical form, and there was a very liberating quality about it.
One of the things that appeals to us about it is just the use of language, which is anything but straight narrative, somebody did this, somebody did that. It's got a dreamlike
quality to it, and yeah, it grows on you.
Yeah, very fluent, and it moves from dream and into reality, and we learn that this character has met a woman who's a poet, but these scenes that with her are interspersed with these dreams that he's having of his childhood and other times.
Well, here's an excerpt from Pink Ocean by Stuart Dybeck, and when people hear this excerpt, they'll have a sense for why we put it in the magazine.
I don't know what I expected. Cowboy poetry, greeting card verse about horses running free. At the very least, her poems were the work of a sophisticated reader, written in a current style, free verse in which the poet addressed herself as you. Their subject, besides you, was abandoned barns, a sequence that explored old barns as photographers do. But the barns in her poems could have only been constructed out of language. Barns the horizon showed through, composed more of slatted light, moats, and cobwebs than warped siding, their tattered roofs askew beneath the frown of crows. Barns like beds unmade by tornadoes, weather vanes still dizzy, washed up barns, driftwood gray, flotsamed with rusted mysterious tools. Barns shingled in license plates, their only history, a progression of dates, different colors, same state, decay. Unhinged doors, gaping shadow and must, recurring hints about divorce and childlessness. A few would make it to the pages of literary magazines. Instead of real drinks, we both ordered tea, which at the chalet was hot water and Lipton's with a wedge of lemon. And here we were, past midnight, in the front seat of her Jeep, a woolen horse blanket over our laps. I was telling her how I once woke with only a phrase in mind, primary play at binary speed. Meaning what? She asked. Maybe the motto for the way I've lived my life, or should live it. Maybe you dreamed your epitaph, she said. Barns in which a conflagration lurked, but where? Not in the stalls or the tack room. The faint whiff of cigar more threatening than an axe. Barns with rooms so secret, not even their rodents knew where the keys were hidden.
You can certainly tell that Stuart Dybeck is himself a poet in this passage, can't you, with the repetitions and those great images and the way he uses verbs. The barn is flotsamed with rusted mysterious tools.
Yeah, it's really lovely and poetical. The flakes went from pink to white. But there's also a very worldly, wry commentary on the current style of poetry, where he talks about how she writes poems that are free verse in which the poet addressed herself as you.
Yeah, we see a lot of those, don't we?
Yeah.
You can read Stuart Dybeck's story in the January 2008 issue of Poetry Magazine, and also on our website, poetrymagazine.org, where you can read everything else that we've talked about in the issue.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is produced by Curtis Fox with Ed Herman.
The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Christian Wyman.
And I'm Don Scher. Thanks for listening.